Welcome to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Camila Kadelska. The University of Wyoming mourned and remembered three UW swimmers that passed in a car crash at the end of February.
However, the unique smiles of Charlie, Carson, and Luke will be ingrained in our memory forever.
Casper is home to Wyoming's only remaining procedural abortion clinic, but its existence is threatened by a bill passed during this year's legislative session.
I know violence is a possibility. I know legally shutting us down is a possibility.
And brick-and-mortar Wyoming food freedom stores are helping producers expand their market throughout the state.
Provides them a lot more flexibility. They may have young kids, they gotta go feed their cows. They don't need to be here to sell their product.
Those stories and more coming up on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News.
Wyoming Public Radio takes you around Wyoming. Listen for interesting stories from down the long streets and around the state. Around Wyoming, weekday mornings at 6:06 and 8:06, and afternoons at 1:30 and 4:48. If you have a Wyoming story of interest, you can send it to me at ingel@uwyo.edu. Thanks.
Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Camila Kadelska. Three members of the University of Wyoming swim team were killed in a car crash at the end of last month. The single vehicle crash happened on U.S. Highway 287 between Fort Collins and Livermore. The 30-mile stretch from north of Fort Collins to the Wyoming line has seen 570 crashes since 2019. At least 15 students from the University of Wyoming have died on this treacherous highway since 2000. Wyoming Public Radio's Weston Pope reports on the tragedy in the community.
On a Wednesday evening, students, faculty, and community pour into the Arena Auditorium on the University of Wyoming campus. Even though a couple hundred people are in this basketball arena, it's eerily quiet and feels empty. They're here at the Life Memorial in honor of the three UW members who passed. UW head coach Dave Denniston is at the right of the stage, holding a microphone. He breaks the silence, giving everyone in attendance insight on how special the three swimmers were to him.
However, the unique smiles of Charlie, Carson, and Luke will be ingrained in our memory forever.
He starts by reflecting on 21-year-old Luke Slaber, who was a junior from Cape Town, South Africa.
To me, Luke's smile always said, "Watch this."
Denniston then shares a happy memory of 18-year-old Carson Muir, a freshman from Birmingham, Alabama.
Carson's smile was the biggest of everyone I've ever seen or coached, and it was usually the biggest, especially after she had seen a baby cottontail right outside the pool right before practice. She loved those little bunnies.
And highlights 19-year-old Charlie Clark's playfulness, a sophomore from Las Vegas, Nevada.
And Charlie's smile indicated that he knew something you didn't. And he wasn't going to tell you what he knew either. And so his smile got bigger and goofier, knowing he had his own inside joke in his brain.
Almost 2 weeks after the tragic incident, Denniston has taken on a task that no head coach wishes for. But he says the UW swim team and community has shown strength and unity more than ever.
I have the honor and privilege of being called coach by everybody here in the front few rows and even a few of you that are up in the stands. By these amazing young people who possess a strength that no coach can pull out of an athlete in any arena or pool.
Another speaker at the memorial was Governor Mark Gordon.
To stand here and think about those three wonderful lives and the tragedy that this university has experienced far too often, it hurts. It hurts deeply. Wyoming grieves. This university grieves. Students grieve.
The University of Wyoming community is no stranger to a tragic event like this. A similar incident occurred on this same highway nearly 23 years ago, where 8 University of Wyoming track athletes were killed in a head-on collision.
This brings back memories of far too fond people that we love dearly. And the comfort of this service, this outpouring of support, this coming together is what we have.
After the speakers, people gathered in small groups around the arena chatting, including a handful of Colorado State University swimming and diving members showing their support. One of those was Megan Hager.
I know that I signed the petition to put guardrails on.
After the crash, a former UW student started a petition to implement guardrails on Highway 287 for safer travel.
I think that would be the bare minimum, I suppose. But we drove up through Cheyenne and around on 287 when I came up today.
Standing next to Hager is Annika Johnson.
I think the swimming community is pretty, like, tight-knit, so when something like this happens, especially, like, so close to our home, I feel like it's not something that, like, we want to brush over easy. I know, like, a lot of, like, conferences around the country, like, also took some time to, like, acknowledge what happened and kind of show their support for Wyoming, so I think it's just, like, a very special community that we have as swimmers.
But it didn't only impact swimmers, says former UW student Hector Martinez.
I really just wanted to come down and pay my respects to the 3 swimmers and, you know, the whole team and just the whole community, too. You know, we all as a community suffered a tragic loss, so just wanted to be a part of that and just be there for the memorial.
Martinez also signed the petition. As of Thursday, it's received 2,520 signatures out of a 5,000 signature goal. The hope is once they get enough signatures, it can convince the Wyoming Department of Transportation or the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration to build guardrails. Those contagious smiles that Charlie, Carson, and Luke possessed will certainly be hard to forget. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Weston Pope.
To the northern part of the state. After more than 2 years of work, officials in Park County will decide whether or not to adopt a document that will guide future land use decisions next week. Residents who live near Yellowstone's east entrance have said that protecting wildlife habitat is important, but there's been disagreement over how much data on big game animals to include. Wyoming Public Radio's Olivia Wheats reports.
Export. PDF.
Wyoming Game and Fish wildlife biologist Tony Mong is pulling up big game use data on his computer.
With this data, we used a mix of both collar locations, which we're putting collars on animals that give us locations at a certain rate throughout the year, and we're using data that we collect from the ground.
The big game use overlay uses GPS collar data to show how often elk, mule deer, and pronghorn use certain areas of the county for winter habitat. Mong says the North and South Fork areas in particular are a winter haven for animals that typically summer in Yellowstone and Grand Teton National Parks. When the county was in the land use plan review process, he presented low, medium, and high use data to county commissioners. Basically, areas on a map where there is a high probability of big game usage versus lower levels of usage. Planning and Zoning Director Joy Hill said that all 3 use categories were included in an earlier draft, but the version going before the commissioners next week only has high use in the main part of the plan. Low and medium use are in the appendix.
The hard point here is you're asking, because the medium and low have been removed, does that mean they could never come back again? And the answer is no.
Hill says that the plan can be revised or updated at any time, even after it's adopted. Early on, the county surveyed the public on what mattered most to their quality of life. More than 700 respondents said that their top priorities were access to public lands and recreation, followed by protecting wildlife habitat and corridors. At public meetings, some residents asked that the low and medium use big game data be kept in the plan, while others worried that having all of it in there could lead to future regulations, like rancher and commissioner Lloyd Teal.
Do I want the possibility of the county or anybody else telling me what I can do on my land because of wildlife? The wildlife are here brought in because of agriculture. So they're going to tell me I can't bale hay at night because it'll disturb the deer. Kiss my ass.
Where are they off today?
It's kind of windy, so they might have tried to get out of the wind and maybe up in the foothills a little bit today.
Mong and I are driving to see some winter habitat in the big game use overlay. Heading towards Yellowstone National Park on the North Fork Highway, we pull off on the side of the road next to an irrigated meadow just past Wapiti.
So there's kind of a ridge line that runs around to the right here where the snow, you can follow that snow kind of to the right.
I see the snow, yep.
Go to the left, you see the big group of snow, and then just to the left of them, there's like little brown dots.
Now I see them. Okay, there they are. About a mile and a half up Sagebrush Hills, about 200 elk are resting on some undeveloped private land that's considered a medium-use area on the overlay map. Mong was out here earlier this week and saw elk walking just east of here through the Copperleaf subdivision. It's a development with 131 home lots and some condos. When I'm back at the office, I call up Joy Hill with the county to see where this subdivision falls on the map. She says it's in the low-use area, but it's also not far from medium and high-use areas. The medium and high-use areas actually impact very few private properties, but there's still a lot of confusion.
People have made their own messaging out of it. Oh, they're going to make us put fences up or not put fences up. They're going to make it be wildlife-friendly fences, or they're going to tell us we can't subdivide, or they're going to tell us we have to have super large parcels or whatever it might be.
Hill says so far, commissioners have not shown interest in having these kinds of regulations, but rather using the data for educational purposes. The commissioners will meet on Tuesday to decide whether or not to adopt the land use plan. Hill says then later this year, the county plans to work with a consultant to start digging into potential zoning changes and ask the public,
what are your thoughts on density? How big should lot sizes be? What types of uses do you want to see in these areas?
Hill says at that point, public officials could decide whether or not the big game use overlay would be formally adopted to create regulations on land use. Mong says including any big game data in the plan at all is a step forward.
And it's going to take using the data that we have available to develop in a way that allows room for wildlife, but also allows people to experience this, what brought us all here to this area anyways, which is the wildness of what's out in the mountains.
Mong says he's happy to work as a partner with the county. Whether or not they regulate land use based on wildlife habitat is up to them. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Olivia Wheats at the Center of the West in Cody.
Up next, some updates on bills that are currently sitting on Governor Mark Gordon's desk. This is Open Spaces.
I'm Caitlin Tan, and I grew up in Pinedale, Wyoming. And by about 10 years old, I came to love public radio. Wyoming Public Radio is the one public radio station for the state. And so Wyoming Public Radio really is the one thing that kind of unifies the whole state and makes us all feel like just one big community.
Do you love Wyoming Public Radio? Let us know at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. The Wyoming 67th legislative budget session ended last Friday, but Governor Mark Gordon has 15 days since March 9th to go through the bills and budget and to make line vetoes, veto bills entirely, sign bills, or let them become law without his signature. We'll take a look at a couple of those bills next. Wellspring Health Access in Casper has faced arson, local backlash, and near constant protests since it opened nearly a year ago. Now a bill that passed the Wyoming legislature aims to place new regulations on the only remaining clinic that provides procedural abortions in the state. As Wyoming Public Radio's Chris Clemens reports, if the governor signs it, the law could leave Wellspring and those who depend on it for care with an uncertain future.
Around 2 weeks ago, the clinic administrator at Wellspring Health Access, Brittany Brown, got a text message from a number she didn't recognize. She was in bed at home.
This one gentleman chose to text me and let me know that if he were to ever catch any of our doctors, he would physically assault them.
For Brown and the rest of the staff, the threat was another in a long list of threats and setbacks Wellspring has experienced since it opened.
When I got hired here, I knew. I know violence is a possibility. I know legally shutting us down is a possibility. I know that there's a good chance that I may not have this job.
That uncertainty continues with the passage of House Bill 148, which made it through the Wyoming legislature this month. It would require the clinic to become a licensed ambulatory surgical center. Supporters of the bill say it's meant to keep women safe when receiving procedural abortions in the state. Critics believe it's an attempt to keep abortion inaccessible in Wyoming if a pending legal challenge to a near-total abortion ban ends up succeeding. They say the bill is intended to force the closure of just one business, Wellspring.
Well, this is the lobby, obviously, where patients and their support people wait and hang out for us, try to make it as comfortable and cozy as possible.
Brown is giving a tour of the clinic.
We want people to kind of just relax a little bit once they get here, because of course, getting here can be quite the ordeal.
Next, we walk down a hallway that leads to the exam rooms. There's a framed sign that reads, "Keep your laws off my body."
This is our recovery room after procedures. Our patients come in here, the chairs recline, we give them a cozy blanket, a heating pad, snacks and drinks.
Wellspring provides a range of women's health services, including pelvic exams, cancer screenings, and procedural abortions for patients in Wyoming and in states nearby that have passed abortion bans. Brown says roughly half the patients the clinic sees are traveling from across the state and the country.
Anybody who's familiar with Wyoming knows that for a lot of specialty care, you better be planning on getting in a car and driving for several hours.
Once they show up at the clinic, protesters from crisis pregnancy centers in the area are often already waiting for patients at the edge of the property. Holly Thompson is a volunteer at Wellspring and a Casper resident. Every week, she and other volunteers escort patients from their cars to the door, often as protesters are loudly praying or shouting things like,
"Well, don't do that. Don't go in there because you're going to commit suicide later in life."
It's personal for Thompson. She had an abortion when she was 21, before Roe v. Wade went into effect.
And the reason I had it is because I was a first-year teacher, a brand-new teacher in Rock Springs, Wyoming, and women could be fired for being pregnant and not married before Roe v. Wade. I promised myself back then that if there is anything I could do to help women in the future, I would do that.
Deborah Cheatham is another volunteer. Her father was an OBGYN in Casper for years. Cheatham says he went down that path after a woman came to see him who was sick with sepsis. After she died, Cheatham's father asked the husband how she got sick.
And he said, "Well, she went to Mexico for an abortion." And my dad asked why she would do that. And the guy broke into tears and said, "We already have 6 kids. We couldn't afford another one."
In-office abortions performed at clinics like Wellspring aren't generally considered surgeries. But House Bill 148 requires clinics that provide procedural abortions in Wyoming to be licensed and equipped to do surgeries anyways. Representative Martha Lawley of Warland is the bill's sponsor.
We have a duty to regulate abortion for the health and safety of women in Wyoming who would choose an abortion.
Lawley's view is that as long as procedural abortions remain legal in Wyoming, bills like hers are necessary to ensure patient safety.
In the event of a botched abortion, it's important that there be a kind of continuity of care between the doctor who performed that abortion and the facility where that woman would be taken to for further care.
But Wellspring's founder, Julie Burkhart, says abortion is one of the safest medical procedures with a complication rate of less than 2%.
For Wellspring, we just did our
statistics for 2023, and we are right there, right on target.
If 148 were to pass into law, Burkhart says she's concerned Wellspring might need to shut down some or all of its services, at least temporarily. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Chris Clements.
Governor Mark Gordon has until March 23rd to veto or sign House Bill 148, or let it become law without his signature. Now to another big topic from the session, property taxes. Wyomingites across the state watched the value of their homes climb during the pandemic, and they haven't fallen yet. In response to this mounting crisis, lawmakers pushed for property tax reform during this year's legislative budget session. This includes four bills that the legislature passed. They're all awaiting Governor Gordon's signature. Wyoming Public Radio's David Dudley speaks with Democratic Representative Liz Storer, who represents Jackson, about the property tax bills and what Wyomingites may expect.
So first, we're going to talk about House Bill 3. I just wonder, where is that in the process right now, and are you happy with it?
So House Bill 3 is a signed bill, signed by the Speaker anyway. I don't think the governor has acted on it yet. It is the bill that will start in 2025 and provide long-time Wyomingites who are over 65 years of age with a significant exemption for property tax, 50%.
And what does that look like for folks in Teton County?
That will be exceedingly meaningful for people in my community. Our median property tax for this year in Teton County is over $11,000. That's more than four times what any other county has. So this is a meaningful reduction in taxes for folks in Teton, especially.
And if my math is right, then if it's around $11,000, it'll reduce that to about $5,500.
That's right. So an $11,000 bill would be $5,500 or so.
What's the age cutoff there?
I believe it's 65 years or older. I'm sorry to say that I actually will qualify, but I'll decide. You will have to apply for it. It won't come automatically. We also saw HB4 expands the property tax refund program that we had already expanded. That over 9,000 folks took advantage of this year. In HB4, I brought an idea to the Revenue Committee to expand the refund program modestly, and there's $20 million in the governor's budget for that. Around 9,000 applicants received refunds through that program this year, and we expect that to grow. There's actually a significant number of people in the state who are actually eligible for that program who have not applied, and I would encourage them to do so if they're struggling to pay their property tax. We don't know everything about everyone in the state, but looking at what we can estimate are income levels, that only on average about 10% of the people that could be eligible are using the program. So it really, if you're struggling, it's a great program. It's still the best program we have and the most constitutional.
Yeah, and I saw some pushback. I mean, how does it feel whenever you're presenting your ideas and folks are kind of pushing back?
So the pushback yesterday was actually on SF54. SF54 is the idea that in the next year we are going to provide across the board property tax exemption that will be a percentage of your residential structure value. We can do that more easily than your entire property. And that's the bill that will be going to conference committee here within the hour. We're still debating how to actually structure that exemption. I came up with an idea that I think allows for people in my community who do have these higher home values, even though they're middle class and they're middle class properties, frankly, but now they're worth, you know, between $1 and $3 million in many cases. So I wanted a way to make sure that everyone across the state got something, but that the exemption was proportional to the amount of tax you paid. So we changed it from a strict dollar figure to a percentage. And then I limited the total amount of fair market value that the exemption can apply to. That will reduce the meaningfulness for very high-end properties, and especially because it will also cover second homes. It's getting applied across the board. So those folks are the folks that least need a reduction in their property taxes, since they own more than one home in many cases, and their home in Teton County may be a second home, and it may be a $10 million home. So they'll get a little bit back, but not too much.
Okay. And then that transitions us into House Bill 45. Where is that, and how do you feel about it?
House Bill 45 is a cap bill. It will cap the increase in property tax values that are driving these high property taxes. So I think we've probably agreed on 4% as the total that a property can increase in 1 year. And while I think it's problematic, it's something I voted for because it was the only way that we can address these double-digit increases that are continuing to take place in the northwest part of the state.
And I mean, I know that over the past, 3 to 5 years, these values have been climbing. Are we thinking that these values are going to hold over the next 5 years, 10 years?
We've seen property taxes go up on average across the state in the last 3 years, 57%. The idea that we're doing with SS 54 is to provide some relief, and recognizing that the last couple of years have had, significant increase, and to try to give some of that back. But we're also recognizing that we can't, that moving forward, property tax is still an important part of our tax policy. And it's the most stable one. It is the one that is the bulk of what people actually do pay in their taxes. And as we've heard from the Taxpayers Association, most people in Wyoming do not pay for the services they get. They don't pay that much in taxes. It's more like $1 to $14, especially if you have kids in school.
Okay. Is there anything I haven't asked about yet that you think that listeners ought to know?
I think everyone should realize that we're trying to strike a balance. We're recognizing that, we're trying to save money, because if we invest money and if we invest these funds that the state has, we can keep taxes low, but we also need to pay for services. We are giving people their money back in the form of services at the county, at the state level. And I think people don't always understand what they're getting and what it costs.
Yeah, because these funds go towards emergency services, schools, and so on.
That's correct. The Taxpayers Association has a cowboy family scenario of a four-member household. For every $4,400, they'll get back $60,000 in services. That's a pretty good deal.
That was Wyoming Public Radio's David Dudley speaking to Representative Liz Storer on property tax bills. We all know Wyomingites take it upon themselves to make things happen. Up next, we'll hear about entrepreneurs throughout the state. This is Open Spaces.
Join us for the newsroom from the BBC, and we'll bring you a fresh and lively look at what's happening in the world. Using our extensive network of correspondents, we take you to the story as it breaks. Get the facts and hear the experts on The Newsroom from the BBC.
Weeknights at 7 on Wyoming Public Radio, followed by Classical Wyoming from 8 to 11.
If you're searching for a break from the news, look no further than Wyoming Public Media. We provide 3 music channels for whatever may be your taste or mood: Classical Wyoming, Jazz Wyoming, and Wyoming Sounds. You can find them all on a variety of platforms for listening, including streaming, Wyoming Public Radio app, smart speakers, and FM radio. Just go to wyomingpublicmedia.org and listen.
Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Camila Kadalska. Did you know Wyoming leads the nation in self-employed businesses? There's a few reasons why Wyoming has become a hotbed for self-starters, and Wyoming Public Radio's Jordan Uplinger dives into why.
Yeah, so I guess it was like the leftovers, but I would basically make this into like a ball and then flatten up a little bit and then throw it in the slab roller. And then, yeah, you kind of just throw a ball of clay.
Yasmin Acosta shows me how she turned a brick of clay into a new home for plants. She runs a pottery business called Little Leaf in Laramie, Wyoming. It started as a hobby for her, growing houseplants and making pottery to hold them. But when she started posting pictures of her work online,
I think people were like, oh, I love that. Do you sell it? And the first time I actually sold, like, took some of my stuff to the farmer's market, I was so scared. I was like, what if people think it's, like, not great? Because in my head, I was like, I'm so new at this.
2 years later, Yasmin's studio is covered with ongoing projects and a large machine for pressing clay. Yasmin is part of 44 million Americans who are self-employed. Starting your own business has become a much more realistic goal in the past few years due to increased internet access and economic change. People in Wyoming have jumped on that opportunity. Wyoming has the highest rate of entrepreneurs in the country, but Sheridan County has the most in our state. Some 50% of residents own their own business. One such couple is the Sturdivant family. Micah Sturdivant is the owner, lead designer, and, quote, chief bucket washer at Whirly Girl Flowers.
And I was able to go full-time, quit my office job in 2018, and be home full-time, operate the floral studio.
And her husband, Nathan, a licensed land surveyor, runs Northern Wyoming Surveys.
About, I don't know, 2020, I opened my doors up and kicked off. It was a tough start, but it's been super fun.
In addition to their businesses, the Sturdivants are also raising a family.
The first year and a half that we had our son, I was still working part-time in an office setting, and it just was heartbreaking to have to leave him somewhere else with somebody else. So that was my primary, like, that was my motivating factor, to be able to build something so that I could be home with him, but also have a little bit more control over our earning potential.
However, being self-employed doesn't mean working alone.
There is help. I end up going to help her schlep buckets. Sometimes I end up building some of the archwork. I end up sometimes helping clean the floors in the studio and sweep all of the beautiful petals out the door.
Yeah. It's very much a like joint effort here, you know, like
we try.
Before we even launched his business, we used my business to help grow our savings so that we would have cushion so that we weren't always operating on such a tiny margin because the buck stops with us.
That joint effort and savings have paid off for them, in part thanks to Wyoming's business-friendly environment, such as the lack of individual or corporate income tax. But another reason is the luck of the marketplace. There's no guarantees when starting your own business. The Bureau of Labor Statistics says approximately 20% of small businesses fail within their first year. And that number goes up with each year, 30% by the end of the second year, 50% by the fifth. And in recent years, many who started a cell phone business when COVID hit have returned to the stability offered by a regular paycheck. So why, in Wyoming, are a little over one-third of all full and part-time jobs self-employed businesses? Well, according to Wenlin Liu, chief economist with the state of Wyoming, it's three simple factors: location, location, and, you guessed it, population.
So I think one of the reasons we were the highest is that, you know, we are a big state, but the smallest population. And relatively speaking, we do not have many large employees. So that's why probably for many people, we do not have that chance to become an employee.
According to Liu, self-employment was already growing faster than waged and salaried jobs. Once COVID hit, people began looking for alternative sources of income, less populated areas, and ways to save money. The result was places like Sheridan County exploding in self-employment rates.
many workers probably lost job. They have to face the economic uncertainty. So that's why they have to, some of them create their own business.
While Lou notes this trend could change in the future, it appears that Wyoming will remain a heavily entrepreneurial state. Wyoming's population, tax rate, and ever-expanding broadband build-out means more and more people have the opportunity to try their hand at self-employment. If that sounds like you, here's some advice from fellow self-employed Wyomingites. Figure out your goals, save some money, get ready to be a jack-of-all-trades instead of a master of one, and then...
go for it. Because I was so scared, and it took me a while to do it, but I love it, and it was so great. I think people just need to take... like, trust in themselves. Like, you got this. You're good. Just do it.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Jordan Uplinger.
Now checking in with a different type of self-starters. Local food stores throughout the state are giving producers another option to get food onto Wyoming plates, an option that's a little more consistent than your typical farmer's market. Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Haberman visited a new store in Lander to learn more about the business model.
Inside Meadowlark Market, shoppers browse shelves stocked with colorful jams, loaves of flour-dusted sourdough, and bushels of fresh basil.
I really love good meat, well-grown meat, and I love lamb, which is not easy to find in our Safeway.
That's Susa Bedient, who lives in town and is perusing a display of seasonings on a long wooden table in the center of the room.
And I'm very excited that it's easy to get here and affordable.
It's opening day at the market, which is part of the Wind River Slow Food Project, a Lander-based nonprofit. They want to provide a one-stop shop for customers like Bedient to get food from local producers all year round.
Provides them a lot more flexibility. They may have young kids, they gotta go feed their cows. They don't need to be here to sell their product.
That's Melissa Hempkin, who helped start the store. She also runs a poultry hatchery 4 miles outside of Lander and has a full-time job at the local community college.
And I don't have time to run an egg route. I get requested a lot for eggs, but I'm not able to deliver or really even set a time often that I'll be home for eggs.
Being able to sell her poultry, eggs, and garlic at the store will be a real time saver.
Meadowlark will just make it way easier. I can just say, hey, go down to Meadowlark. Whatever I have available is down there.
This kind of space is possible in part because of the Wyoming Food Freedom Act. So, producers can sell food without licenses or inspections in certain situations.
They can try out grandma's recipe and see if they like it and, you know, go sell at the farmer's market, direct to consumer.
Another part of the act allows for a store to serve as a designated agent for those producers.
Meadowlark never purchases it. They just hold it in their space and then they're the designated agent to sell it for me as a producer.
The market doesn't get paid by producers, but instead takes up to a 25% commission from all sales for their role as designated agent. The market is currently staffed completely by volunteer hours. Up on a little hill outside of Lander, two pigs munch on bits of sourdough bread near stacks of hay bales.
These are some of the luckier pigs in the county.
That's Anna Schmecks.
They have access to some corn, but they're raised mostly on scrap from the local restaurants, so extras from the bakery, the Chinese restaurant in town.
Schmetz produces pretty much anything you can think of. All sorts of meat, fresh veggies, and alfalfa. She's selling beef, honey, and eggs at Meadowlark and is part of the board. She says she's optimistic about the market's start.
Today was a huge sale day. Already I can see just crunching the numbers.
But the real question is whether those sales will continue over time.
So I'm hoping that the kitchen gets going.
Extra squelchy.
Yeah.
Meadowlark has a commercially inspected kitchen that people can rent to help scale up their product. They're also planning to host cooking classes and pop-up dinners from local chefs, all of which will hopefully keep the market afloat. Jen Faulkner is the local foods coordinator at the University of Wyoming Ag Extension.
I think they face a lot of challenges that a lot of startup businesses have. So securing funds to establish themselves is a hardship.
There's currently 13 of these sorts of stores operating around the state. from Casper to Sheridan to Laramie. But Faulkner says managing them is no cakewalk.
Conventional markets have some pretty streamlined processes in place that these markets are having to be a little more creative around.
Morgan Doyle is the manager at Fremont Local Market in Riverton and knows that creativity firsthand.
The paperwork, the structure here, the systems that we use to operate, that was a learning curve. But knock on wood, I think we've got that pretty well mastered now.
They've been open for about a year and a half and have been a big resource for the folks at Meadowlark.
We're going in the right direction. We are super close to being sustainable. We have over 90 producers here.
Doyle's dad, Steve, helped start the store and says their next plan is to build a coffee bar and continue helping others start similar stores in their own communities.
We have a lady coming up from Rawlins. They want to develop their own Wyoming Food Freedom Store. We've had several of these. We're pretty stoked on that.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Hannah Haberman.
Up next, the Yellowstone National Park Superintendent speaks on employee housing. This is Open Spaces.
In the middle of winter, a wildfire flares up and consumes whole neighborhoods outside of Boulder, Colorado. It turns Ariel's childhood home into ash and rubble.
Fire outside. We're evacuating.
The Burn Scar, Season 7 of The Modern West. Binge all 5 episodes plus 2 bonuses. Find them under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org, sponsored by the Argosy Foundation.
Did you know that all 6 episodes of Human Nature's latest season are out right now? That's right. Season 9 of our award-winning podcast has a little bit of everything. A Wyoming man who spent his summer working as a night shepherd in Switzerland.
All I could hear was my breathing and the steps, and everything was so dark. And I just thought, okay, this must be what it's like to be an astronaut on the moon.
The story of one of the biggest animal rescues in history.
And I picked up the phone and they said, when can you get here? And so the next day, I actually took a plane because it never occurred to me what was ahead for me over the next few weeks.
And a woman who followed the gray whale migration hundreds of miles with her son.
I was exhausted one evening, fed up of trying to work. I'd had a really bad day. And so I was like, right, I'm not working. I'm going to read about whales.
Find Human Nature on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. That's Human Nature, one word, one N.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Camila Kadalska. With low inventory and high prices in gateway communities, housing for Yellowstone National Park employees has been an issue for a while. Wyoming Public Radio's Olivia Wheats speaks to Yellowstone Superintendent Cam Shawley about how the park will use a recently announced $40 million gift to continue investing in employee housing. The conversation starts with Shawley sharing housing upgrades the park has made recently.
We've gotten rid of all of the 1960s and 70s trailers and replaced them with very comfortable, high-quality modular housing. That's been really, really huge. We've also put a considerable amount of effort into rehabilitating other housing units, many of which hadn't been touched, you know, since the 80s or 90s, you know, carpet, appliances, things like that, that we need to have, you know, good housing to attract and retain good employees. This donation is helping us address something that hasn't been funded up to this point, which is an issue that's been developing for years and is going to get worse as we move forward, not just here in Yellowstone, but in parks across the National Park System. And that is parks that border expensive gateway communities like West Yellowstone or Gardner or Jackson Hole, where the availability of long-term rentals simply really doesn't exist anymore. Most of the rentals have turned into Airbnb and VRBOs. And so even if employees want to live outside the park, it's become more and more difficult for that to happen. Housing prices in many of these areas are, I just described, are very, very expensive, unaffordable, especially to lower graded employees, even higher graded employees for that matter. And I'll give you an example. Here in Mammoth, where headquarters is, about 5 miles from Gardner, Montana, We have somewhere around 100 employees that had housing outside the park. And they bought their houses, you know, back in the 90s, early 2000s, when you could buy a house in Gardner for $150,000. A huge portion of that group of people, and that's just one location in the park, are retiring. You know, they've hit their 30-year mark or 35 years, and they're moving on with life. And these are critical positions, things like plumbers or radio technicians or snowplow drivers or you name it. And so when we go to replace those positions, their replacements can't afford housing and there's no rentals. And so what this $40 million is going to do is actually allow us to add housing capacity to counterbalance what's happening outside the park. And, you know, we think that this is going to be a huge help over the next couple of years, because we have had numerous people turn jobs down because of a lack of housing.
When you say adding on to housing capacity, do you mean that the park is going to add more housing inventory within the park? Can you tell us more specifically about how those funds will be used?
You know, we'll continue with the modular approach. We're going to look at some different types of modulars. The modulars we've put in over the last couple of years to replace trailers have been primarily for seasonal employees, because the seasonals were the ones living in the trailers. So this next round of modulars that we'll add to the housing inventory will be a mix of, you know, 1, 2, and 3 bedrooms designed to give us flexibility for whatever demographic we end up hiring. We have, you know, sometimes single people, sometimes couples with a kid, couples with a couple kids. So we need kind of a full range of, you know, 1, 2, and 3 bedrooms around in different locations in the park. And we're doing a very careful assessment of how many units are needed, where they need to be placed. And that's what we'll be focused on here with this donation over the next couple of years.
Do you know yet how many new modular units you'll be able to build with the funds? Or are you still assessing that?
We're assessing that, but it'll be probably 70 plus in that range. And all of those units will go into existing developed areas. So we're not necessarily expanding the footprint, the developed footprint of the park. You know, about 0.023% of the park is, you know, parking lots and hotels and housing and things like that. We're going to stay within those developed footprints anywhere we decide to put additional housing.
Why is investing in employee housing important? Like, why is that a priority for Yellowstone at this time?
You want to attract the best of the best, no matter what industry you're in. And, you know, housing is not just an issue within the national parks across America. It's an issue in many sectors across the country, especially in areas that are, you know, resort communities, things like that, that are very expensive. And, you know, whether you're a restaurant owner or a hotel owner, or you're running a national park, you need high quality employees to come in and help you operate things to the standard you want. And as we look at last year having the second busiest year on record, it takes people to manage people, and it takes people to protect this park. And so you want the best of the best doing that. The best of the best aren't going to come and either live in trailers, or they're not going to come and, you know, to areas where they can't have or afford quality of life off work.
Looking forward to the summer, what are you anticipating? What are you looking forward to? What are some of the challenges that you foresee for Yellowstone this summer?
You know, last year was the first year we didn't have a flood or COVID for a while. I mean, it was nice to have, I guess, what you'd consider a normal year. It was really busy. I think this year will be equally busy. You know, we're continuing to really pay attention to increasing visitation and what impacts increasing visitation have on the resources of this park. What impacts does increasing visitation have on staffing and infrastructure? Once again, it takes people to manage people. You've got to have the right level of staff in this place to manage increasing visitation. And, you know, so people don't really think about, you know, what's it take to empty 2,000 garbage cans, you know, four times a day instead of two, or you know, you put a million more people in this park flushing the toilet five times per day. What's that do to your wastewater systems? We treated over 100 million gallons of drinking water last year for visitors. Those are a lot of invisible things that people just kind of don't think about. And so for us to continue to manage increasing visitation, we've got to, our staffing has got to keep pace with that. And, you know, that's probably, you know, the biggest challenge is making sure that we've got adequate staff in the right locations throughout the upcoming year. We're doing a lot of hiring right now for the upcoming season. And, you know, we'll see what happens. But I think it's going to be a good year.
That was Yellowstone National Park Superintendent Cam Shawley speaking with Wyoming Public Radio's Olivia Wheats. Thank you for listening to Open Spaces. The entire show and all the stories you heard here can be found on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. It can also be found wherever you get your podcasts. And we post all our stories on the station's social media platforms. Thanks to Hannah Haberman, our producer, Ivy Engel, our digital producer, and Eric Vigil, our social media manager, for today's show. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio.